Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk baseball.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks, Dave Slade, and welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. I'm John Manuel, joined by J.J. Cooper and Matt Eddy in alphabetical order there. We're not proceeding in any order. We're just cranking through National League Central. We had the Cubs the other day. Still have three other NL Central teams to plow through, and we've got to get through the National League West next week as well before we do a mega pod and talk about the top 100. And instead of, we're going to go so big, we go beyond a podcast. We'll go to national television Friday on February 10th on MLB Network at 9 o'clock. That's where we'll unveil Baseball America's top 100. We'll have tons of content at Baseball America and baseballamerica.com. Of course, the print edition online, and of course, here on podcasts. But guys, we're here to talk about the Pittsburgh Pirates and keep going through the NL Central. And we go Pirates today because there's recent news, a good news peg again, with the Pittsburgh Pirates with the surgery on the left knee of Josh Bell. Josh Bell's going to factor pretty heavily into our top 100, Matt, but this is the third time, apparently, he's had a knee problem with the left knee and second surgery. Got to imagine that, you know, I hadn't thought about it before the surgery. I just assumed Josh Bell's going to debut in the big leagues this year as a starter, not debut, but be a regular for the first time and come off of our list. And now a little uncertainty thrown in with this latest knee problem for him.
Yeah, the chronic nature of the injury is troubling, as is the fact that he's kind of a bigger body guy. He relies on that mass to generate power.
And he's going to have to, you know, this is a guy with, I don't know about percentage, but defense is not why he's in the top 100.
No. You know? That's to me, the concern I have is that this is a 2 to 4 week recovery, supposedly. That puts him back anywhere from basically reporting date for position players to just a couple weeks into spring training, really just at the start of games being played. So from that standpoint, it would not seem like it's that significant. That being said, the question Josh Bell has is very little about how well is Josh Bell going to hit. The question is he playable at first base? We're not asking for, is he average? Is he playable?
And no one's asking him to be James Loney over there. We're asking him to be basically Kendrys Morales. I like your comp the other day. That was
Switch hitting first baseman who kind of controlled the zone fairly well, hit for some power. Does it trouble either of you guys that it's his left knee? When he's batting left-handed, it would be his back leg.
Switch hitter is going to, you're saying you're getting a little bit more.
Well,
there.
He's not going to go right only. That's not his forte.
No,
right. Forte.
No. I mean, that I don't know. I mean, I guess I would say from the standpoint of, I just don't know. Like, is this something where every 5 years he needs an oil change and so they fix his knee and then he's got, because we're not talking about reconstructing ACLs or anything like that. We're talking about this has been loose bodies, basically meniscus tears, things like that. But it is something where I would say it's fair to call it a reasonable cause for a little bit of concern, because it is, if this was the right knee, you'd say, okay, well, those are two unrelated things. This is the third time. This time missing time is really inconsequential time. It's not games.
This is the best time to have that procedure. You're going to miss the month of February. It's the shortest month. It's the month that you probably do the least in terms of, I mean, you're ramping up. But that's where he discovered the pain in his left knee was off-season workouts. As opposed to, I'd rather have him figure that out in off-season workouts than when you're in spring training. So timing-wise, he could still have this procedure, which he did, get healthy, which he should, and then the month of March, spring training is long enough anyway, especially this year with the World Baseball Classic.
Yeah.
So Josh Bell should have time to get ready. And if he's not, at the big league level, you have John Jaso, you have David Freese. You do have options. Mm-hmm. Although I know there's some questions about Jung Ho Gong's availability with his off-season escapades. I'm not sure how you say that in Korean, but he's had some rough off-seasons. I think they were counting on Josh Bell this year. And that's one of the reasons, guys, that this is a highly rated farm system is they have players who've had success in the upper levels. Josh Bell's one of them. Tyler Glasnow's one of them. Kevin Newman had some success in AA. And our number one prospect, Austin Meadows, had really, I just think, as far as prospects who were in our top 100 last year, he had about as good of a year making that step from never having played AA before to what he did in AA, Matt. I mean, how much did he rise in your estimation? I mean, did he really... where did you have him kind of last year? How did you view him after 2015, and how did you view him after 2016?
Well, this year he made the jump into my top 10. I can't recall exactly where I had him, probably 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
The power he showed this year was unprecedented for him, but I think probably not for scouts who liked him out of high school. He's definitely a top 10 caliber guy now.
He really, the guys who liked him out of high school, I remember doing draft coverage in 2013. If you liked him then, you likened him to a Jay Bruce. JJ, you've been doing the Reds for a long time. Do you see those similarities, Jay Bruce, and better, not as good?
I have to say it. I hope for his standpoint, better from the standpoint that Jay Bruce, there's been knee injuries. We talk about knees. There's been knee injuries, I think, that are a key part of Jay Bruce and why Jay Bruce has been less than what we expected. But
he still had a perfectly chronic career. He's had a good career.
He's had a good career.
But he hasn't been a superstar.
But when he was coming up, I mean, he was our number one prospect overall, and when he was doing that, it was, this is a guy who's going to hit for average in power. Right. And there have been few seasons when he's been able to do both at the same time. I do think Austin Meadows has a chance to do both at the same time. I do question the one thing with him, and since it's a minor one again, but we're talking about Pirates prospects, there have been some freak injuries, but Austin Meadows has so far had the trouble of being a guy who can get out there for 125, 130 games. And some of those are, you get hit in the face, you get hit in the face. That's not something where you're brittle or anything like that. But that is kind of one of the last things that he has to check off.
He did it in 2015. He played 127 games that year. I mean, that was a year where he really didn't have injury
14
issues.
He had it. 16 he's had it. But the other question, which is a good situation that the Pirates have, In a lot of systems, we would be talking about Austin Meadows and saying, okay, this is the center fielder of the future. And maybe he is in Pittsburgh, but they have an outfield where you have a lot of options for that. And you kind of look at it right now and you say, okay, I mean, we kind of thought there was a pretty good chance that this would be the offseason that Andrew McCutchen was sent somewhere else and kind of clear the way for Austin Meadows. Obviously, that has not happened. I mean, do you think, I guess I'll pose it to both of you guys, do you think Austin Meadows spends the majority of the year in the minors this year or spends the majority of the year in the majors?
I think he probably spends about equal time. That's where I think. I mean, I really think that the Pirates, if they have any problems contending in the National League, National League Central, that they are going to try to move Andrew McCutchen. They've already tried to move him, and I think wisely they didn't try too hard to move him. They weren't 100% we're going to move him, because when you're like that you're going to settle for a lesser deal, and they didn't do that for a franchise player like that. But I do think that they're probably not going to be a lock for a playoff spot in the National League, because they're not going to win the division. The Cubs are ridiculous, and I don't think they're in position to challenge the Cubs for the division. That means they're going to have to challenge for a wild card spot, and that's just, can you keep taking chances? I think there's going to be an opportunity for them to move Andrew McCutchen, and I think that's fine that they do have a ready-made replacement in Austin Meadows. I think the key thing for me is Austin Meadows doesn't have to play center field. I think he can play center field, but he's a 180 isolated power for his career. He was really hitting for a lot of power last year. He hit for a lot of power the year before when, the 407 slugging in the Florida State League is really good when 337 is the league average for power, for slugging. So this guy's got power. There's no questions to me that he's going to hit for requisite power to be a corner player in the big leagues. And I think left field is a better fit because he's not as good as Gregory Polanco and right field. So to me, a Polanco, Marte, Meadows outfield plus the bounty you could get from Andrew McCutchen is a way forward for the Pirates. It's not the only way, but it's a very good way forward depending on what they get for Kutch.
And theoretically, trading McCutchen could make this team a better team because, again, you have a ready-made replacement there who's also very inexpensive. Allows you to also reallocate money a little bit. Like, I mean, that's the thing that is frightening. If you're a Pirates fan, the frightening part of this is we saw last year how financially limited in some ways this team is because they made a trade at the end of the year that is still a little bit puzzling. The Liriano trade, okay, you're getting rid of Liriano. You're thinking that he needs to move on. I get that. Drew Hutchinson, okay, you're taking a chance. This is the kind of guy that the Pirates have reclaimed many times before.
He's a reasonable option, I think, for a rotation spot. I mean, I kind of like, if it had just been Liriano for him straight up,
that'd have been fine.
Hutchinson straight up to eat that contract, that would have been a pretty decent return. So I understand giving up one prospect, Reese McGuire and Harold Ramirez. that was surprising. But that said, those two guys aren't great prospects.
No.
McGuire, to me, has more value.
It says a lot about how the Pirates view them internally, too.
I think the industry views them the same way. I think fans overrate those two guys. Neither right. one made the Blue Jays top 10, and the Blue Jays traded away a lot of prospects. I know, you know, I like the Blue Jays system better than you guys do, but, I mean, like, the Blue Jays aren't in the top 15 for us in farm system rankings. And I think that's probably a consensus view in the industry. And these two guys didn't crack a top 15 system's top 10. So I don't think it was puzzling at the time. It's still a little puzzling, but I just don't think those two guys are great prospects.
And especially, I don't disagree with you. I still find it like what I'm saying though is that did show the sign of how financially up against their ceiling they were, that it was like just to get free from this contract.
I guess what I'm saying is most teams would have done that. Because most teams would have seen, if you didn't think Francisco Liriano was going to work for you anymore, any team would want to get out from under a contract like that. I think that's the whole industry. Who wants to have what they would view as $13 million in dead weight on their contract? Now, the Blue Jays didn't see that as dead weight because they were making a postseason run and their pitching staff needed some help. And they thought they could help Liriano. I think really the whole key is your evaluation of Liriano, not the evaluation of those prospects. I think the industry agrees those two prospects were significantly flawed. I guess that's the difference between how you're viewing the trade and how I view the trade. To me, the whole trade is contingent on, do you think, for instance, Liriano can help you? Because I think everybody else thinks the prospects are iffy.
But in that Pirates rotation, how much do we expect to see Glasnow versus 2016 rookie Tyone will be in the rotation as well?
And Stephen Brault, I think, is the other kind of guy in there. They have, a lot of recent graduates. We've talked a lot about with the Marlins how they gave up. Jim Benedict was important to them. They have to get better developing their own pitching prospects. They gave up a player in Trevor Williams to get Jim Benedict.
John, we did not give up a player. We traded Trevor Williams for a player who was then released.
Let's be honest. The Pirates were Organization of the Year last year in 2015, and one of the reasons for that is they're creative. And one of the ways they're creative is all these things. Oh, don't look at this. No, we traded Trevor Williams for a player. Now, we released that player as soon as we got him.
Pretty much.
Don't look at Matt Ford and all these old players who we signed in these minor league contracts. Don't ask about that. They're really coaches, really, in the minor leagues.
The Pirates have a player coach at every minor league affiliate.
Every minor league affiliate.
Signed to a minor league contract.
So I'll give the Pirates credit. They're creative, and they have to be creative in their position. They're in a very difficult neighborhood.
Very difficult neighborhood.
So they have to be creative, and one of the ways they also have to constantly re-nourish their big league rotation, and they're doing it, Matt. They're pretty good. I'm looking at their depth chart. Garrett Cole, they got first overall in the draft. He has to pitch like a number one starter in 2017 for them to be a good team.
Being healthy would be a nice start.
I would agree. but he has number one stuff,
yes.
And he has number one bulldog, like, pissed off. Like, I like Garrett Cole's attitude. Mm-hmm. Jameson Taillon, who had a fantastic year last year as a rookie, especially after missing 2 years. Right. Yvonne Nova that they re-signed. But then Chad Kuhl, Glasnow, Stephen Brault, Trevor Williams are their homegrown options to go with Drew Hutchinson, their trade option. That's kind of what they have to do to survive, isn't it? To keep on replenishing this pitching staff with homegrown players.
I thought re-signing Yvonne Nova was smart as well. He really thrived under their system.
He did.
Yeah. Glasnow is obviously the big X factor here. Tyler Glasnow, number three prospect in the system. Two-time number one.
Right.
Throws hard, hammer breaking ball, doesn't throw enough strikes.
And throws hard.
Can he throw enough strikes?
Hammer breaking ball. When you talk about guys who do not get hit, Tyler Glasnow he's not just at the top of the list.
Consistent.
He's at the top of the list. And then there's this gap among prospects to the next guy who doesn't get hit. Mm-hmm. I mean, his career average against, I think, for something like 170.
It's 172.
172.
It's sick.
172. Now, if you go year by year during Glasnow's career and look at what the best average against in the minors is most
years. Why don't you just tell me what you want to do and I'll look it up.
It's like 175. Like, his career average against would ranks basically among the league leader. I mean, the minor league leaders each year.
It's his career high was that 2013 year with 142.
But
I know we're leading up to this.
But the thing with that is that as that gives him a better chance to survive than most pitchers with his flaws. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That being said, it has to. His control has to get better, and that's the thing we've been saying. We were saying it in 14. We're saving 15. We're saving 16. Here we are in 17. The control has to get better. And there is a concern how much of that is that how much body control, because we see it in other ways too. He gets great extension, but the reality of it is that he also, if you are standing on first base and you are capable of running full speed from first to second, you've got a pretty good chance to steal, you know, if you are a 30 runner or better. He struggles to hold runners. There's these all, you know, these little things, and it all adds up to, does he have the body control to make the adjustments to, not that he's not going to show glimpses, but to make the adjustments to where you hand him the ball and 6 or 7 innings later you say, you know what, there was never that inning where it all just fell apart.
Yeah, he is susceptible to the big inning.
Yes.
Because he does not pitch as well out of the stretch. If you get on base, you can run all over him. He doesn't field his position very well. And it's, you know, sometimes it seems like the walks just snowball on him. And all it takes sometimes is that one hit. He may only give up that one hit in that inning. But if there are already ducks on the pond, suddenly there's going to be a crooked number, to use two cliches right back to back. So that's the problem for Glasnow. And he got exposed. So I don't think we're overreacting to what he did in the big leagues. I've seen that critique of us ranking him number one right. 2 years in a row and then not this year. It's really more a matter of he hasn't fixed what ails him. And that's the only thing that ails him. But that's going to be exposed. He's going to be a sitting duck in the big leagues.
But he didn't fall back as much as also the two guys who are ahead of him in the Pirates rankings moved up.
And that's so Meadows is just a really good high ceiling and high certainty prospect. It's very easy to see him being a solid average regular. I have very little doubt that he'll be able to do that. Comparing Glasnow to Mitch Keller, Matt, that's just where you're going upside. Like, Keller doesn't quite have as much upside maybe as Glasnow, but he does it so much easier, and it's just so much more. He's so much more the conventional prospect. He's not 6'8". Basically, right. For me, the fact that he's not 6'8", almost did it almost by itself.
JJ has researched Keller a lot more extensively, but I want to just touch on Glasnow,
yeah.
What he showed in his brief major league debut last season. There's no doubt about the swinging strike ability. That's plus. Fastball velocity. That's plus. Just doesn't throw enough first pitch strikes. So can he land? Can he throw a first pitch breaking ball, a surprise strike? Can he get that in the zone? Can he come back from a 2-0 count by locating his fastball? I just don't know if he's answered these questions.
Because when you're behind, you're going to have to get hitters out when they know what's coming to be a starter. You're going to have to, a few times a game, beat a guy who's a big league hitter who's looking fastball. And you have to beat him with a fastball in the zone consistently.
And the thing about it is that thing for in the positive for Glasnow, if you are talking to me and asking me about guys who just with a smidgen more command could do that, Tyler Glasnow's fastball doesn't have to be 97 for
right.
him to generate swings and misses in the zone.
Right.
There is something about his fastball that generates swings and misses. It's the extension, whether mm-hmm. it's the life, the descent, all of it together.
Downhill
plane, all of that. He is a guy who generates swings and misses in the zones and weak contact, which explains the 172 career average against. But you're right. Can he do that consistently enough? Because at the big league level, again, he wasn't. Now, we're not talking. This was not Dylan Overton's debut.
Right.
But this was. We saw the flaws of Tyler Glasnow, as you would expect, got magnified when he reached the big leagues.
Have we ever gotten a good comp on him?
You know, to be honest with you, no.
No, he's pretty
unique.
He's unique.
I mean, he's like a leaner Jeff Niemann. Like, he's that size. And, you know, you wonder
deliberate.
If he has... He is deliberate. I always thought that he would be a better athlete because I assumed more athleticism was in there when the fact that the brother's a decathlete. Division I decathlete who actually had Tommy John surgery at Notre Dame throwing the javelin, which I think was pretty
That's
hilarious.
Awesome.
Yeah, I love that tidbit. And the mom was a gymnast and a gymnastics coach, Division I gymnastics coach. So I thought, like, when I was researching him in the Florida State League and he came through, it's like, this guy has to be more athletic down the line. And I just thought, okay, as he grows into his body and matures physically, there will be more body control. There will be this athleticism that has to be in there. When you have these genetics, and you know, I'm not Dr. Moreau, I guess I couldn't get in there and really see that's the first geneticist I could think of. I guess I was putting too much stock, JJ, in the other athleticism, in his athleticism, because you just, when you watch him, and you wrote about this in 2015, it's just not apparent that he has the athlete, the body control to improve.
That's the concern. Like the thing I kind of, the guy I think of that there is at least some similarities is, I do think of Giolito at this point, because they are both, they're different, but they are.
Giolito is similarly sized. But that, 6'6", 250.
The size wise, it is, they're both very big guys. The thing I do want to remind us with Glasnow again, and I am still pretty optimistic on Glasnow. Again, he didn't move significantly down in our rankings.
You're buying Glasnow more than Giolito.
I mean, because Glasnow throughout his career, if you say what does Glasnow have to do right now to be a successful big league pitcher, you hit on it. It's not that his stuff has to get any better. It's literally just if he just throws more strikes, if his command and his control bump up by a grade, he'll be fine.
See, I see more evidence that Giolito can fix what ails him than Glasnow can fix what ails him. So I'm more optimistic about Giolito.
But Glasnow, the other thing is that he's 23. He's a 6'8" pitcher who's 23. And it's understandable. I mean, we've been writing about him for a long time. I remember when he was in the Sally League, and it's like, right, man, look at what the year that this guy Tyler Glasnow's having. All that. But it may be, again, he is a guy, if you ask me, that said that, and the Pirates are a team, if you were going to pick an organization to be in, even post-Jim Benedict, that said, okay, are they going to figure out a way to get it out of him? Yeah, I think that this is a good organization to be in. That being said, if you told me that he ends up being a guy who we're talking about at 26 saying it hadn't come together, and then we talk about him as a 28-year-old, and we go, mm-hmm, wow, there's the guy that we've been looking for.
But that's Giolito, too.
Yeah. I mean,
he's 6'6". Yeah. Same thing. So Giolito getting his old velocity back, I think, is much more likely to me than Tyler Glasnow all of a sudden figuring out.
But if Giolito gets his old velocity back, the fastball's still not as good as Glasnow's.
That it doesn't have to be. He just has to throw. He already throws more strikes. He's around the strike zone more. All he has to do is figure out how to set that breaking ball up. The breaking ball is still there. He still has feel for spin. He can do what Matt just said. He can drop in a first pitch breaking ball much more than Glasnow could do. So again, it's not either or. They're both. I think it's more likely. Who's more likely to be a star? I would say Glasnow. Who's more likely to be a consistent third or fourth starter? Giolito. And Giolito still has a chance to be a star. Who's more likely to be a reliever? It's Tyler Glasnow.
Yeah. And JJ, you had the South Atlantic League top prospect list this year, so you got a lot of feedback on Mitch Keller. Hit us.
Scouts love Mitch Keller.
And so do teammates. Teammates.
Yeah, we talked to a couple teammates love Mitch Keller. The thing that stands out with him, little bit, not unusual, but we're talking about a 2014 draftee who really, 15 was not a lost year, but it was kind of, I mean, there you didn't, Mitch Keller kind of went into almost hibernation in 15.
Well, this is what the Pirates did. They were very aggressive with high school pitching in 2014. They had a lot of picks. They had extra picks. They took spent a lot of money on Gage Hanson in the 11th round.
That's kind of interesting.
I think Trey Shupak, who they drafted high in that draft at a high school in Texas, they already traded him. So they took three high-dollar prep arms, Hines, Shupak, and Keller. And Keller was the first one they took, 64th overall, I believe, out of an Iowa high school. Gave him $1 million to take him to buy him out of North Carolina's signing class. North Carolina had six signees who were drafted in the first 64 picks that year. Keller's the best one. Forrest Wall and Jack Flaherty were supposed to be better. I know there's another high. Bukauskas was also, I believe, that year who wasn't drafted, but he was in our top 30. So they had a big recruiting bounty that year. Keller was the one they thought they were going to get that they didn't get. They thought they had a chance at Wall and at Flaherty. But so Keller was, you know, late bloomer also that year too, JJ, in the draft. And he's coming into it.
The reality is when you say late bloomer, when you're an Iowa kid,
right,
you're going to be a late bloomer. They don't play baseball during the spring. You're playing you're not playing a high school baseball season during the spring, I should say. But with Keller, you hit on it. The thing that stands out to everyone who sees him is that it's really good stuff. But more than the really good stuff, it is present for his age. For his level, the fastball command and control is really advanced.
Just a sidebar: 18 walks and 23 starts. That's really good for a young
pitcher. For a guy who has stuff that literally the stuff grades out as, could this guy be a front of the rotation starter? Absolutely, the stuff's there, and he's doing that already. He's locating that stuff in a way that very few pitchers at that age with that kind of stuff, rarely, they very rarely do that.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is that he's not just some command and control guy. He was up to 96 in the Florida State League playoffs when he's at, what, 120, 130 innings? It's and he's got, again, their bloodlines here too. Older brother John Keller was in Nebraska, then went out to the Division II school, was in the Orioles organization, I think is still there. He's 96, 97. So Mitch has similar arm strength, much more athletic.
A better body for
body control. That's right.
Better. It's not, you know, he got the fortunate pair of genes from the standpoint of, like, again,
he probably wishes he was as tall as his brother, but he's not.
But I kind of feel like we've kind of, as a, like, if you said one of the things that we've become more attuned or whatever is when I started at Baseball America, if I saw that a pitcher was 6'8", I always thought of that as a big advantage. And I've kind of, I think you guys do somewhat too. Like, I kind of now look at it. Yes, every now and then you hit the absolute one in a million lottery, and Randy Johnson, because of his height, is absolutely dominant. It's just a lot harder, though, to be 6'8 than it is to be a 6'3 pitcher.
The best quote I've ever heard about this is a scouting director, National League Club, said, "There's an awful lot of 6'2, 6'3 right-handers in the Hall of Fame."
That's right. It's very true.
It's really the sweet spot. 6'2 to 6'4.
I think you're big enough to get plain. You're big enough to be durable, but you're not too big to where all of a sudden it's like, how do I control these massive limbs?
Honestly, the best tall starter of the last, you know, the 21st century is Adam Wainwright. He's the best one. Yep. I think we listed him as 6'6". He's really 6'7". He's a massive dude. But clearly he has athleticism.
Syndergaard is 6'6"-ish?
I think he's right around there, but let's see him do it for 15 years. That's all. I mean, I love Noah Syndergaard. You know, don't get me wrong.
He's going to at you on Twitter.
He probably will. I'd love it if he did. But Adam Wainwright is that guy, and he does all the he checks every big guy box. But he also has athleticism and incredible work ethic. I thought his career was going to be shot when he ruined his Achilles tendon. But he's come back from that. I mean, he wasn't as good last year, but he is the gold standard for taller for out of the sweet spot in this century. And he's not. I mean, Randy Johnson's a total freak in a great way, with all due respect. But asking someone to be Randy Johnson is too much.
That's fair.
But the other thing that does worry me a little bit with Glasnow, when you talk about floors for guys like this. The big guys like that often have more difficulty. A lot of times if I told you, hey, I've got this pitcher, no one ever hits him, he walks too many guys, there's concerns about the command and control, you kind of usually would say, you know, he throws, by the way, he can throw 96, 97, and especially you could probably throw more than that in shorter stints. You'd say, okay, he can move to the pen. It's hard. That's another thing, though. When the 6'3 guy moving to the pen, again, and I'm not saying Tyler Glasnow needs to move 10 pen anytime soon, but the fallback option for guys, it's harder for the big guys to move the pen a lot of times, because a lot of times those are the guys who need longer to get loose throw.
It's just all about athleticism. If you're a big guy and you're stiff, you're not going to have fast control, not to mention command. And if you're a big guy who's stiff, it's going to take you a longer time to get loose. So you're looking for – that's why I'm looking for loose – I'm not. Scouts are looking for looseness. Scouts are looking for athleticism. And when they keep saying that, that's what's reflected in my rankings of pitchers. That's why I really like Mitch Keller. A guy who is a real split camp guy when it comes to scouts was Kevin Newman in the 2015 draft. And you would talk to Pac-12 coaches, and they'd be like, "Yeah, we pitch Kevin Newman inside with fastballs, and he doesn't hit the ball hard. It's like it's not rocket science. If you locate inside to him, we get him out." But with Wood, he has been a guy who's always hit for high average. Did it in the Cape Cod League. He ranks fifth. I think it's a sign of a good system, Matt. If you have a middle infielder who's hit at AA and gotten to AA and has the Wood hitting track record of Kevin Newman, if he's your fifth prospect. At the same time, I think it's also fair to put him a full step behind his peers from that 2015 draft, the Benintendis, the Bregmans, the Swansons. Those guys went higher in the draft because there's more power there, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, Newman had an exceptional year in the Florida State League, hit 370, rounding up. So it looked like his drop at Altoona to 290-ish was severe, but, you know, 290, it still puts him a 60-70 hit.
And
you know?
Your first professional season, that's really
exceptional. Explain when you say that, because I know I've had scouts text me that they get angry when you do that, but you're not saying that that makes him a 70 hitter.
Right.
Explain that to people so they understand.
That's a present evaluation of his hitting ability in 2016.
Just saying that. What you're saying is that
it's not a projected grade.
Right. What you're saying is that the analytics say that he was a standard deviation or two standard deviations above
the league average.
The league average.
Correct.
So Just to clarify
that. I think scouts who like him would give him a 6 future hit.
I think that's fair.
45 power.
That's the real question, is how much power do you think he has? And if there were guys who saw him as like, this guy could be Alan Trammell, you know, borderline Hall of Famer. Like he could come into power later. You see it. You do see hitters who do that in their careers, who don't hit for a lot of power in the minor leagues and then get to the big leagues. A, they use titleists. They use the tighter wound ball. The ball does carry more. Big league ball carries more than the minor league ball, period. That's something in this power spike that we see in the big leagues. The ball is, I'm not saying livelier. It's just a different ball.
It's a better ball.
And second of all, hitters do learn, you have more bats. You're a more experienced hitter. Yeah, you're facing tougher pitchers, but you're just a better hitter when you're 27, theoretically, than you are when you're 22. If you've gotten there and you've survived, you've seen more, you've got a bigger mental registry of pitchers and what you face and situations. So Kevin Newman could be that guy who comes into power, but his present power, I don't think it's debatable that it's not average present major league power. He had 5 home runs last year. He did have some slugging and nice slugging numbers, but it was under 100 ISO in Double-A in his short time there. I think he actually makes more of an impact offensively by being a top-of-the-lineup type of guy, a guy who can steal some bases, smart base stealer, or smart base runner. To me, there's a lot to like with Kevin Newman. I just don't see him as a future star. I see him as a future very good player.
Yeah, Alan Trammell is way too lofty.
For me, it's too lofty.
But
I have heard it. I've heard it from two guys, one area scout who had his for coverage and one national cross-checker. But they seem to be in the minority of the scouts I surveyed in 2015. And guys in the Florida State League liked him, but when I threw that comp at him, they pretty much were like, no, not that kind of impact, not that kind of power. But I think he'll be a better player than Jordy Mercer, who's been their regular. And I think he's right on time. This is Mercer's last year in a contract, so Newman, I think, will be their regular. And I also think it's fantastic that he played in the same infield with Kevin Kramer last year. So he had Kramer and Newman together again, riding high. I'm sure driving purloined mail trucks around all over the Florida State League last year, at least in the first half. If only Mike Costanzo had been a player coach on that team, you could have had quite the infield there. And maybe Alan Bennis's kid.
Bennis, yep.
We could there are no Seinfelds in the minor leagues. Who else did you like in this top 10, though? Because for me, I like Cabrian Hayes. He wasn't a top 100 guy for me.
He has to do it over. I like Cabrian Hayes.
It was an average year in the South Atlantic League.
It was an average year. You want to see him take a step forward in 2017.
He's flashed top 100 talent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He hasn't, for me, done it.
He's got to do it more consistently. Over a full season to be a top 100 guy.
There's still some questions, it seems like, with him as well. But who is a guy that you like out of the back half of their top 10, Matt?
I'll say Elias Diaz, who had a lost year last year. You know, keep an eye on him if you play in a Stratomatic League. Future -3 arm coming up on this guy.
Nice.
He can really throw.
Captain's Award winner in 2015. But, I mean, does he have the survival tools to figure out hitting? I mean, this is an organization that seems like they figured out the catcher thing.
Mm-hmm.
The way they've developed Cervelli at the big league level, they kind of resuscitated Russell Martin's career. They're doing something right with catchers at the big league level. I do think Diaz factors into that in the future.
And with Reese McGuire out of the way, smooth sailing.
Reese McGuire is out of the way. Who do you like on the back of their top 10, JJ? You could say Cabrian Hayes. He's technically in the back of their top 10.
I think Brault is a... Brault is, when you talk about split camp guys, I've talked to scouts who say that they don't think that Stephen Brault is a big league starter. They think of him as just one of those, you know, there's plenty of lefties out there. He's one of those. I've talked to other guys who think, no, you're talking about a guy who could go out there and be a solid number 4 for a while to come. And there's a lot of value in that.
He is one of the, again, from this phylum of the low slot lefty that is becoming more prominent in the game.
It doesn't mean he's Chris Sale, but you'll always now when a guy is describing a Brault type to you, he'll say it's a Sale type delivery.
Right, and there's Adam Conley, who we've talked about, who has that kind of delivery. Josh Hader it might even be lower slot, but Brault is from that family, Matt. But he's always been more of a strike thrower than a stuff guy. But it seemed like the stuff played more and the command played less at AAA last year.
That is the puzzle that he needs to solve. Because, you know, you like the strikeouts and the swing and miss he showed this year. But you kind of wish he had that old control too, because
right.
his walk rate really cratered this year.
So there's deception. There's an above average slider. Times a plus changeup. The guys who like him see average fastball, above average to plus secondary stuff. That phylum of player works if the command
right.
is that's solid the, average or better.
And that's, again, it's so much true with young pitchers. There's very few pitchers. That's what makes Julio Urias so special. There are very few pitchers who arrive in the big leagues, and that's not the last thing that they need to check off the list. And Stephen Brault, Tyler Glasnow, both fit in that. That's what Jameson Taillon was so impressive about him last year. And that, to me, when I look at the Pirates, and I know that last year was a disappointing year, but I do look at it and say, like, I feel like that the Pirates, even in this very disappointing season where they did not really contend.
They won 19 fewer games at the big league level. I mean, that's bad.
It's a bad.
You go from 98 to 79, that's
a bad
year.
Season. That said, I do feel like when I look, they did that, and part of one of the reasons they dropped back is that they had to use a whole lot of young arms in the rotation. Taillon came up, Glasnow pitched in the big leagues, Brault and
Chad Cool.
They used a lot of guys. The thing that I do think that it helps them for the long term is that I feel like that they kind of went, when you talk about, they're not really rebuilding in a way, but I see much more of the core of their 2020 team now having had some big league time. If they're going to succeed, if they're going to make this window last a long time, they have Polanco, they have some of these guys locked up who they need to be, they need Gregory Polanco to kind of be the star in the second half of this decade, much like Kutch was in the right. first half of the decade. But that's
Or Starling Marte.
But those are plausible. I mean, that's not... They're not asking, all I've got to do is I've got to roll double sixes here, and if I don't, we're in trouble. They need Gerrit Cole to be that front of the rotation starter. That's not asking something that's crazy to ask.
But it needs to happen now because he's going to be gone in 2 years.
Right.
So that's the thing for Gerrit Cole.
But the thing about it is that can Jameson Taillon or Tyler Glasnow, could one of those guys be the guy that steps into that role after Cole leaves?
Very possible.
They have guys where you have plausible options there. Mitch Keller would be, ideally Jameson Taillon moves into that role and Mitch Keller moves into Jameson Taillon role at that point.
I got to say, Taillon kind of concerned me with the change in approach this year. He's much of a more ground ball approach.
It is the Pirates' way.
I know. He got hit in the zone. He did not miss bats in the zone at all last year.
It's consistent with our scouting report. If you just looking at their internal notes, the scout in here who was talking about seeing their AAA team, and that he watched Taillon for a full game, and he got two swings and misses, and Brault came out the next day in one inning and had seven swings and misses in the first.
I'm just registering my concern. I'm not saying he can't be good, but...
Because JJ's in the other camp. JJ's a big Taillon fan.
My thought is like, I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree with it, but at the same time, over a pretty large sample last year, his emphasis on throwing strikes and getting weak contact worked pretty well. I didn't see anything in there that said, this is... completely a smoke and mirrors year that he can't replicate.
It's more likely though that Keller and Glasnow are the future one. Not
I would probably agree with you on that, but I think Keller's the future.
Right, me too. The one thing that to me the Pirates need to do to pry this window open longer is draft college hitters better. And they have the track record is the track record. I'm not going into their reports. I don't see who they had rated. I'm not talking about whether they got their pocket picked. I don't have that information. All I can do is scoreboard. When you scoreboard their college bats outside of Kevin Newman, who was a first-round pick, Kevin Kramer in the second round, Casey Houston in the third round in 2015, those guys are not factors. Kramer's in their top 30. Lefty bat, doesn't run, future utility profile. That's Kevin Kramer. Like, utility, like first base, second base, third base, maybe a left field. That's Kramer. Hello, that's Kramer. Connor Joe, 39th overall, 2014. That was a massive reach at the time. The only way he was a pick there is if he thought he caught. He didn't catch. He's got a bad back. Didn't like the pick at the time. Hasn't worked out. Jordan Luplo, they moved from the outfield to third base, back to the outfield. I think he's just not – Michael Suki. These guys are just not guys, So this is an analytics-inclined organization. They use the analytics very well. Other teams that do that do better in the draft with college position players – than they do. They had the one guy they liked, the 2013 draft, they got a couple big league college bats, Jacoby Jones and Adam Frazier. I really like Adam Frazier. I could even see him being that Josh Harrison type. That was a guy I regretted that we ranked low last year on opening day in 2016. Neil Huntington told me the guy that he thought that we relied on was Adam Frazier, and he was right. Adam Frazier had a really nice rookie year last year, lost his eligibility for being the prospects, but the guy can hit, and he hit in college at Mississippi State, and he's hit so far as a pro. Jacoby Jones, they traded, I forget, to the Tigers for what, but he's a high variance guy.
Soria, I believe.
Joachim Soria. But this is a guy who probably fits best as a 300 or 400 at bat guy. He's never controlled the strike zone. Yeah. But if you want to pry this window open, you got to have some cheap position players, and you got to find David Freese in the draft, not in free agency. You find Jung Ho Kang, find those types of players. And they used to do that. Jordy Mercer wasn't a high draft, it wasn't a first round pick, but they're doing it less well in the last three drafts than they did it previously. And so, when you have, when you're in the same neighborhood as the Cubs and the Cardinals, you better find hitters as well as the Cubs and the Cardinals. And that's really where the gap is. The number one gap between these organizations is money. But the number two is those two organizations draft hitters better than the Pirates do. It's just, that's just going scoreboard.
And that leads to the, another divisive player, Will Craig.
A good way to finish things off, exactly.
Will Craig, number nine, who, as when you are looking at the season he had last year at Wake Forest,
it was a monster season.
It was a monster season.
He's done it for 2 years.
And, oh yeah, by the way, he would also come in and pitch relief for them, which doesn't really provide much value to the Pirates. But it was, but that said, pro scouts who saw Will Craig in his debut last year are not real sold on Will Craig, the ones I talked to.
And there were scouts who saw him as an amateur who weren't real sold on him. And there were scouts who saw him in high school who weren't real sold on him. Again,
Tennessee class of 13.
But our first write-up of Will Craig is in 2011, teammates with Daniel Norris in East Tennessee. When Daniel Norris's team goes and faces Farragut High School, it's supposed to be Norris against Phil Pfeiffer. But so East Tennessee was loaded in that range. Nick Senzel was on that same team with Farragut. Mm-hmm. So there's the same draft class. The only teams that offered Will Craig for hitting, I believe, were Samford and Wake Forest. And to me, I confuse him all the time with Alan Craig, and I think they're very similar players. Minus athletes, big bodies. At one point, it would not surprise me if Will Craig has an Alan Craig 2013 season where he's a really productive middle lineup hitter. But do I see him as a future star? I do not. And just like Alan Craig, you're going to have a hard time finding a place on the diamond for this guy to play. He should be a third baseman. He's got a rail gun for an arm at third base. But he is, when you watch big league third baseman, his best body comp is like a David Freese type of player. And I don't know that he's even as agile as David Freese. So that's the real issue for me with Will Craig. The other issue is his wood bat hitting history is sketchy. Was really not good in the Cape, and he was Jeb Bush-like up there. He was a little low energy up there. So scouts do think he's a little low energy. But the guy can hit. He's country strong. I like him personally. He seems like he's got a chip on his shoulder in a good way of the doubters, and maybe he's going to add this rant to it. He was not a guy that – he would not have been a first-round pick 20 years ago. Scouts would have just seen the body. They wouldn't even have cared about the college stats, and he just wouldn't have been a first-round pick. The analytics were what made him a first-round pick. He slugged 702 and 731 the last 2 years at Wake Forest. That ranks third in 2016 and fifth in the country in 2015. That's what made him a first-round pick. But with Wood, the power track record is much sketchier.
Yeah, he had two home runs in the Penn League.
I don't think he had any in the Cape in 2015. So I'm a little bit surprised that he still was a first-round pick based off what he did in the Cape. But he just was so good in the regular season. That's what did it. So for me, he's going to be a referendum on their college bat draft track record. And the recent track record of those college bats does not make me optimistic. So anything else, guys? Seems like a good place to leave it with me ripping Will Craig. And I hate that because I love the Tennessee prep class of 2013.
No one loves the Tennessee prep class of 2013.
We can spend 20 minutes talking about Alan Hansen.
He's so hot right now.
I'm just kidding.
He's actually not so hot right now.
He is my favorite player in the system who's a future waiver claim or minor league free agent.
he may need a new address to get better. But I thought your favorite player was actually Max Maroff. You like Max Maroff?
No, I like Hansen.
You like Hansen better than Maroff?
Oh, yeah.
That's a tough one. JJ, Max Maroff, or Alan Hansen? It's not that hard.
No, I mean, these are the kind of things, like, it's funny, like, when we're talking...
The correct answer is Adam Frazier.
But, yeah, that, I mean, really part of it is that I would probably say more off at this point, but it's very close. But this is the kind of thing, when we were in our top 100 meeting at the start of the week, and we literally did, we had, like, there was, I think it was, like, 32 and 33. We had, like, a 10-minute discussion of 32 and 33. This is amping that up.
When yeah.
We could have a 10-minute discussion of Alan Hansen versus Max Moroff, which would be,
ooh.
You know...
Well, the other thing is, let's predict, we'll get Hudson Belinsky to predict which high variance prep arm in Florida the Pirates will draft high in 2017, because last year was Brandon Ogle and Travis McGregor. McGregor, who wasn't a BA 500 guy, I don't think, and they took him in the second round. I think he was actually lower in the 500, but not a consensus second round pick. Ogle was a guy who popped up early, but I have a lot of confidence in their ability to draft and develop pitchers. I have less confidence in their ability to do it, especially with domestic hitters. But let's see if Kevin Newman proves me wrong, and then Will Craig, see if he proves me wrong. But there is stuff to like in this system, but the National League Central, we'll keep discussing, is tough. And there are some really other good farm systems in this division. Cardinals and Brewers still to come, and the Reds. So this is one of the more interesting divisions. The NL Central has it all over the American League Central, in terms of farm systems especially.
Although the American League Central says, look at how often we've, you know,
I'm just saying in farm systems.
Yeah. They're saying yes. That may be true. And now they have, the NL Central does have your, you know, World Series champs. But the AL Central, for all its flaws, is saying, hey, look, don't talk about AL East. We're the division in the American League that sends teams to the World Series.
I'm saying flyover country's where it's at in terms of these farm systems. Mm-hmm. I kind of like it. So we'll talk about another one tomorrow. Which one? We don't know. We'll figure it out when we come in the morning. For J.J. Cooper and Matt Eddy, I'm John Manuel. We'll talk to you tomorrow on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? Be a better fan. Visit BaseballAmerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.